Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And we're really pleased to say we have a guest on the show today. That's Erin. Hi, Erin. How are you?
Hi, nice to meet you.
Really good to have Erin on the show. Before we kick off, Erin, would you mind doing a little kind of brief explainer about who you are?
Okay. So my name is Erin Burnett. I'm born and raised in Belfast. And the main thing that I talk about is autism, specifically autism and the church. How the church can respond to the growing numbers of people who are being diagnosed with autism, and how autism might impact how someone interacts with the church.
Fantastic. And we're really pleased to have you on the show, because we've actually wanted to do an episode about autism for a while, in part because we had a really interesting question, which I just want to quickly read out from a listener called Christian, who emailed in at molad@premier.org.uk. And Christian wrote this. He said, "I myself was diagnosed with ASD, that's autism spectrum disorder, in 2022, not as a child, but as an adult. We hear an awful lot in society about autistic children being, quote, a nightmare for parents, but is that really true? Autism has lots of strengths and weaknesses and a wide range of disability level. I'd love to hear your perspective on God's view of autistic people, our place in society, and how new or potential parents should think about autism. Why do you guys think ASD diagnosis numbers are on the rise? And there's also my concern that in the future, a prenatal test for autism could be developed and cause autistic people to all but disappear, just like with Down syndrome." So there's a lot going on there. We'll come to some of those later issues, I think, later on. But Erin, before we kind of dive into some of the issues, we'd love to hear a bit more about your own story, because you weren't diagnosed as a child with autism, were you? So what was your, could you tell us a little bit about what your childhood was like when you first started to realise you might be different to some of your friends or peers?
Yeah, so growing up, primary school generally was fine, but I had the benefit of being in quite a small country school, so there were no difficulties apparent at that stage. It was as soon as I moved to secondary school that things started to go wrong. Secondary school is hard enough for most people, but it's just compounded if you're in any way neurodiverse. It wasn't a bad school. I just never really settled. I was never able to make friends. Or as I got a bit older, even if I started to make friends, I couldn't keep them because I didn't have the skills to maintain a friendship. So on the whole, I was just dreadfully lonely, but also quite academically able. So from the school's point of view, they didn't really see an issue because results were coming in and I just sat there quietly, so it wasn't apparent how much I was suffering. I'm trying to remember precisely how the diagnosis came about. I'm pretty certain, yes, so I was referred to the school counsellor and spoke to them about how things were going, and then ended up with CAMHS, which is the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Service. And in hindsight, I now realise I was quite lucky to even get as far as CAMHS with how waiting lists are going. So that's something I should be grateful for. Initially, I was treated for OCD, Obsessive Compulsive Disorder, because some of the characteristics of autism are actually quite similar to OCD, which is probably why they went down that route first. But when things weren't really improving, particularly with the social aspect, it was only then that autism was mentioned for the first time as a possibility. It wasn't something I had considered before, but honestly, as soon as they said the word, it was like things fell into place because it explained everything. And I was 18 at that point, but in Northern Ireland, I don't know if it's the same in England, CAMHS couldn't directly diagnose autism, so I had to go on another waiting list, which I think was 5 years long. So I had the privilege of being able to go private and getting that diagnosis at 18, but that privilege is not available to everyone. So that's the long roundabout story of how I was diagnosed at 18.
So you talk about the suffering, the pain, and was that mainly about loneliness, just the fact that you found it so difficult to make friends at school, or was it this feeling of feeling different, that you were just somehow different from those around you?
It was both, because the two were related. Mm. Particularly at school, when there's quite defined peer groups, the main way to interact is by liking the same things as other people. But because I couldn't quite break into any of those social circles, I think that's what was causing me such loneliness. But on the flip side, to be more positive, once I got my diagnosis and went to university, things got much, much better.
So why was that? What was it about university and having this label? I mean, there's a lot of discussion, isn't there, about whether it's good to have a label or not, whether that's in some way dehumanizing or stigmatizing.
For me, I found it very helpful because it gave me an answer for why things were the way they were. And I think a lot of people do go through a phase when they're first diagnosed where autism essentially becomes their whole identity, because they're learning about this whole new aspect of themselves, although that calms down a bit in later years. I think there's a few reasons why university was better. You know, I had the diagnosis, so I had more confidence in myself and the confidence to be different. Also, the fact that you're studying what you want to study, it's easier to surround yourself with like-minded people. It was just generally much better than school.
And did you find yourself kind of seeking out or drawn to other people who were diagnosed with ASD? Or did it actually, having the label, meant that you could kind of enter into the friendships and relationships with others that had been more difficult at school?
A bit of both. And funnily enough, a lot of my close friends from uni got diagnosed with autism subsequently in later years. So I didn't even know they were autistic when I made friends with them. But I think just subtly like must attract like.
So what was it about those friends? In looking back, you know, what did you have in common? What was it that drew you together? Even if, were you a bunch of nerds, you know, that there were that you were different from the others?
Pretty much, yeah. We were the theology nerds. And also the fact that I chose not to drink at uni, not out of any great moral reason, but it wasn't my thing. So I think the people who choose not to drink, there's also a correlation with being nerds. So
and so you'd get together and discuss theology while,
yes,
while
everyone else was going out clubbing. It sounds a lot actually like my university experience, except that I wasn't either a theological student or don't have autism, so I'd have no excuse. I'd love to know how you found as well, both pre and post diagnosis, being part of the church, because I think you grew up in a Christian home, didn't you? And so church was a big part of your kind of upbringing. Did you find that as lonely, as isolating as school could be at times, or was it a different space?
Church on the whole has been a very positive influence for me. Like you say, I grew up in a Christian home, so I grew up going to church. And one of the main benefits of church socially is that it's a community where all ages come together. It's one of the few places in society where people from like 0 to 100 can gather in one place. And studies have shown that people with autism find it easier to interact with people who are either older or younger than them compared to their direct peers, probably because there's less peer pressure. So I've always ended up making friends with people who are much older than me, but that's great. So in that regard, church was a very supportive place for me when school wasn't.
That's really interesting. I haven't heard that before. And actually, on a completely different tangent, I'm very interested in intergenerational friendship. So can we just unpick that a bit more? Why would it be that someone on the spectrum a younger person finds it easier to engage with older people?
A big part of it, I think, is the lack of direct peer pressure. Because if you're not developing at the same speed as your immediate peers, then it can be hard to form those solid friendships. But with older people in church, I think a lot of them, I don't know if this is true, but it seems like they get to the age where they just stop caring about social norms. And that's when I make the best friendships.
So it feels a bit more kind of liberated because you're not having to kind of pick through all the unwritten rules of that, particularly, I guess, as a teenager, as you said, school is full of unwritten rules and cliques and boundaries that you're not supposed to cross and things you're not supposed to say. And in some sense, I can see that it's just a bit simpler and easier when you're talking to the grannies at the back of church. And did you find after you were diagnosed, was your church, did anything change? Did they kind of treat you any differently now that there was a label? Did it make things better? Did it make things worse?
So my church story as I was growing up is quite funny. So when I grew up, I went to just a fairly mainline Protestant church. But as I was a teenager and when I was struggling at school, one of the things that comforted me was getting into the Bible, getting into theology. But autistic people do tend to be quite obsessive and literal. And of course, I didn't know I was autistic at the time. So I took an obsessive and literal approach to the Bible. And because of that, I decided to change church. So I no longer went to the one my parents went to. I went to a more, I suppose you'd say, fundamentalist one. And although I don't go to that church anymore, I don't necessarily regret it because it was a necessary stage of my development. But yeah, so I was at several different churches growing up.
So theologically, you think that there's a natural tendency for people with autism to be drawn to a very literalistic, black and white, would you say, a detailed understanding of the exact text of the scripture? Would that be fair?
Yes, because we tend to have a very logical way of thinking. So a lot of the autistic Christians I know would be quite into apologetics and things like that, trying to logically explain the Christian faith. And in my case, it's also, you know, I had no understanding yet of the idea of, you know, nuance and context. I just literally took everything completely black and white at that point.
And in your further theological studies, you're now doing a master's degree, is that right, in theology?
Yes.
How have you found your autism, your neurodiversity interacting with your further study? Because I guess I've heard it said the whole point of a theology degree is to kind of break apart all of your preconceptions and kind of break it down and build it up again and in a much kind of richer, detailed, nuanced, colourful way. How have you found that process?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened to me at university. Even though I went to a confessional theological college, so we were still learning it from a Christian point of view, but even at that, it still breaks down everything and you basically build it up again from scratch, which is terribly unsettling at the time. But I think I've emerged with a faith that's more robust and more, I suppose, in keeping with how I see the world.
And one of the things we'd love to talk about is how wider society approaches this question of people who are on the spectrum or have ASD, because it feels like the culture has been on this massive journey, in many ways a really positive one, where maybe 50 years ago, people with autism were often kind of slightly feared, shunned, isolated, sometimes even institutionalized. And whereas today, a lot of the conversation around autism is really celebratory, quite joyful, about inclusion. It's obviously overwhelmingly a positive thing, but I wonder, do you have any thoughts on your own kind of approach? Do you sit on the spectrum somewhere between like autism is a terrible thing, autism is a brilliant thing? Are you somewhere in the middle? How do you see it?
So yeah, as you say, as humans, we love extremes. No one wants to go back to how it was in the past, where autism was considered a disease and people were hidden away. But on the flip side, I am slightly uncomfortable with some of the changes in how we talk with autism in terms of, you know, autism is a superpower. That may be true for some people, but it can inadvertently erase the genuine suffering autism can cause for certain people and their families. So my approach, I try to be middle of the road, and I acknowledge that there are many, many benefits to being autistic, which I can go into more detail if you want. But I also think we need to be realistic about the challenges it can pose, both for autistic people ourselves and the people who look after us.
Yeah, thanks. It's a fascinating discussion. And for me, you know, as a paediatrician, like many other paediatricians, we've been on this journey where we always thought and were taught that male autism was much more common than female autism, and that we saw a lot of children who were socially very inept and they didn't care. They just did their own thing. And what we now realize is there's a much greater equality between the two genders in this neurodiversity, but that we recognize that it seems that a lot of women present in a very different way. And in particular, they're much more concerned to conform with social norms. It seems like, whereas many of the blokes just don't give care, they just, that's the way I am, take it or leave it. It seems like a lot of women, understandably, are trying to learn the rules, trying to fit in, trying to work out how to conform. Does that ring bells with you?
It does, yes. The term is masking, that women and some men try to mimic the actions of the people they see around them. So they're not intuitively behaving this way, but they're doing so to try and fit in. And because of that reason, they do blend in more, are less likely to act out in school, and therefore less likely to be diagnosed.
So I was really interested to say that you, these friendship group you had of the theology nerds, subsequently, some of them had a diagnosis, but at the time, they were just theology nerds. They were just, this is who I am. I don't have a label. And so I have a sense that there may be many more women with who are neurodiverse who are actually taking part in church life, but have never either themselves recognized their own diagnosis or anyone else has. Do you think that's right?
I think so. In fact, recently I got a really lovely email from a lady who's a professor at a Christian university, and she was diagnosed with autism when she was 60. Wow. So there are a lot of women who have gone their entire lives knowing they were different, but never getting that diagnosis.
And so one of the negative things that I've read, because I have found this topic quite interesting, is that it's possible for women with autism to be more vulnerable to be abused, particularly by men, because they may be less capable of sort of picking up the signs, interpreting the nuance of maybe a predatory male or something like that. Is that something, again, that you recognize?
Yeah, well, thankfully, from my own experience, that hasn't happened to me, probably because I'm lucky to have a very supportive family background. But I can definitely see why that would be, because if you are lonely and seeking that social validation, seeking a relationship, but you don't have intuitive knowledge of what's right and wrong in a relationship, I can see why you would be quite vulnerable to abuse. Hmm.
And I wonder whether that therefore leads us, particularly in church, but in other kind of social context, how can we make these spaces kind of safer spaces for people who are on the spectrum or are neurodiverse? Are there specific things that churches or other communities can be doing, both that they're kind of welcoming, but also helping people who maybe find it harder to see red flags or harder to navigate social nuances? What are the kind of, are there any practical things that when people ask you the ways that they can make it easier for neurodiverse people to be fully included, fully engaged and safe?
Just having a voice, I'd say, is the single most important thing. Not presuming that because you have read something about autism that you therefore know what they want, autism is such a broad spectrum. I can't speak on behalf of really anyone except myself, and if that resonates, great. But I think the key is getting to know the individual and their own strengths and weaknesses. And that's the basis from which you can work with them, provide pastoral care, provide spiritual support.
Because I suppose going back to our conversation about, you know, the kind of overcorrection from autism as disease to autism as superpower is that it also kind of, as you say, smooths over the incredible diversity, and that there are some people like yourself who are, you know, thriving and succeeding in their chosen careers, writing books, appearing on podcasts. But there are other people, you know, who have ASD who might need profound kind of 24-hour care, and calling it a superpower in that context feels quite disrespectful to the reality of their experience, that actually they're not able to look after themselves, and maybe they need kind of, and will always need for the rest of their life, quite a lot of additional support.
Yeah. And of course, it should go without saying that just because someone has profound autism, they're no less in the image of God and no less deserving of dignity and love. And also, being nonverbal does not mean non-communicative. You know, you just need to learn the different ways in which they communicate, which may be very different to you and I, but not to completely write them off. But I do agree that the spectrum is so wide, it's hard to talk about in a coherent way. Interestingly, in America, because I was talking to someone from America recently, they diagnose autism in levels. So I would have what's called level one autism, and it would go up to level three, which is profound autism. But as far as I'm aware, that's not something that's caught on in the UK yet. We're just all the same autism diagnosis.
And I think this is one of the worries that paediatricians and others have about labelling, that because it's not just in autism, there are many, many other conditions, congenital conditions, you know, and these days with genetic analysis, we're able to diagnose hundreds, thousands of very rare congenital syndromes, sometimes called dysmorphic syndromes. And I have a lot of concerns that this, almost like a kind of stamp collecting, coming up with a label, and it seems to be both positive and negative. Sometimes having a label, as in your case, was a very positive thing. It was illuminating for you. It enabled you to do more reading and research to understand yourself and other people. But I do think there are other cases where the labeling is almost dehumanizing. And one of the wonderful things about Christianity is it says that we're all unique. You know, that part of what it means to be a person is to be an utterly unique constellation. You know, there's never been anyone like you before in the history of the planet, of the cosmos, and there never will be again. Each one of us has that utterly unique and wonderful sense of being the first and only people like me, person like me.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is what you do with the label. So in my case, it might have been easy to say, oh, I have autism, therefore, that explains why I can't make friends, and therefore I will never make friends. Whereas a more healthy way to look at it would be, oh, I'm autistic, I now understand my difficulties. Using that knowledge, let's work on it. So using the label as a basis for self-improvement and self-understanding rather than writing yourself off.
And I'd love to hear a little bit, we mentioned it earlier about there are many like positive benefits for having autism. Could you share a few things that you feel in your experience have been kind of been blessings, if you could use that language, about being on the spectrum?
Yes. So we have the ability to get very intensely into things we're interested in. And that's a particularly useful skill when you're doing academic study or when you like writing, because it allows you to really intensely focus on the task at hand. We're also quite good at thinking outside the box, which again is useful for academic fields. You may come up with slightly different ways of looking at things, which can enhance the conversation.
Yeah, it's interesting because I, in previous career, worked as a research scientist with many other researchers. And you certainly recognise quite a lot of people in the field of scientific research, particularly, who, although they've never been diagnosed, have definitely got some of those neurodiverse traits. In fact, I've just remembered I was talking to my boss, who was a very eminent professor, male professor, and he said he'd just been reading about what was then called Asperger's syndrome, which is now would be regarded as a sort of high functioning autism, and he said he's just realised what he's got, and he was a very successful, internationally renowned researcher. So I do think that there's a kind of systematizing focusing, which in the worlds of academia and scientific research has often been highly successful. And I think it's well known that many of the pioneers in scientific research, when you go back and read about their lives, you could recognize that they were neurodiverse. And it was their very neurodiversity which led to this astonishing scientific creativity.
Is that, does you find that kind of conversation encouraging, that there's this kind of hidden seam of brilliant people with autism going through history who may have never been diagnosed, but actually that, you know, they're not necessarily kind of written out of the story, or always, people weren't always kind of shut away in institutions, but actually there's this kind of legacy that you are taking forward as someone who is neurodiverse. Does that resonate at all with you?
It does. Yeah. In fact, it reminds me, quite a few years ago, I read the autobiography of Hans Christian Andersen, you know, the famous Danish fairy tale writer. And he never got an official diagnosis of anything, but just reading through his biography, I was like, this is me. So it is encouraging to see that, yeah, autism's been around forever. And these people have achieved great things because of their autism. So it is quite encouraging.
It's often because they have been able to focus on one great thing, isn't it? Rather than the sort of person who has a very busy life because they've got lots and lots of other things, all these relationships and friendships and everything that they're keeping up with. The person who's neurodiverse is often able to focus much, much greater. But along with that can come the loneliness and the and the sense of being different, and sometimes ostracized from. I have a female friend who has self, you know, she's told me that she's on the spectrum, and she's told me that she really loves coming to Bible study, group Bible study. She just loves getting into the Bible. But she always comes 10 minutes late to the Bible study because what she can't do is the small talk. So when the group come together, you know, she's tried working out how do you do small talk and how do you talk about the weather and what you did last weekend and how do you work out when to say and what to say and what would be appropriate in the small talk, what would not be appropriate in the small talk. and she finds it just too difficult. So she just comes late so we can concentrate on the Bible study.
To Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
One of the other things that really interests us, and I think interests you as well, is the increase in diagnosis rates in autism in recent years. Whereas I think historically, correct me if I'm wrong, Erin, but it was kind of thought to be potentially 1 in 100 people, but there are some recent studies suggesting it might actually be much more common than that. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it is absolutely undeniable that autism diagnoses are increasing It is undeniable that diagnoses of autism are increasing exponentially. The debate is then, is this because we're simply recognizing it better, or is there an actual organic increase? So there was a study done quite recently in Northern Ireland, where I'm from, about school, primary school age children. And it found that 5% of primary school age children have an autism diagnosis. And that is really high. And when you break it down by gender, it was 3.5% of girls, but 7% of boys. So that's really high, almost 1 in 10 boys. So undeniably, rates of diagnosis are going up, and these children will become adults, and the church needs to be equipped of how to deal with this, how to welcome these people, how to encourage them to explore their spiritual gifts.
Do you feel like we're not ready for this as a church? Do you think there's a lot of work to be done to ensure that this coming generation of people who are neurodiverse can be kind of fully included, fully welcome, fully engaged, you know, rise into leadership positions as the time comes, all that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think up until now, the church is getting better and better at dealing with neurodiverse children. There's a lot of emphasis on having neurodiverse Sunday schools and youth ministry, which is fantastic. But I have found that this drops off as soon as you turn 18. There's very little out there for autistic adults. So the church, on the whole, is doing really well with children, but I think where it needs to step up is continuing that support through adulthood.
Just going off a slight tangent, can I just ask you a question about social media and the whole digital world, artificial intelligence? I'm fascinated by this in general, and the way that increasingly some group of people are being drawn towards artificial intelligence relationships. Have an AI girlfriend or an AI boyfriend, a companion who's always there, who's friendly and chatty and is always interested in you. And I'm just wondering how people on the spectrum react to that kind of the artificial intelligence companions. Do you think, as a generalization, they will be more attracted to it, or will they be less attracted to these kind of artificial companions?
Well, of course, I can't speak for everyone, but I could see the attraction in that, you know, real life relationships, not just romantic relationships, but friendships as well, you know, can be messy. There's a lot of give and take. Whereas with an artificial language model, you get some of the benefits and none of the drawbacks.
Yeah, that's right.
So I can see why that would appeal.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's more, it will learn to respond to you in a way, you know, unlike a neurotypical friend who may find it quite hard to work out, you know, what you like best. You could see how a sophisticated AI system, which is constantly learning from your own responses and kind of modeling. Of course, the great concern about this, both psychologically and spiritually, is that it's really a kind of narcissism. I mean, what I'm doing is I'm staring at myself. I'm staring at a kind of artificially constructed simulacrum. And that is utterly different from this wonderful Christian understanding of relations, of agape love, of reaching out to the other, of being of union and communion, of unity and difference.
Yeah, because as people on the spectrum, we tend to be very good at self-understanding, but not so good at understanding others. And that's something, you know, I have to continually work on and probably will work on forever. And the danger is that we end up with a generation of neurodiverse people who are essentially completely cut off from wider society. They get their social interaction from a computer and that's it. It's a potential danger.
Mm. And I feel like that would be such an indictment on wider society. You know, we've talked about the same question when it comes to kind of older people, housebound people. Let's just give them all a robot companion in the future that will look after them and keep them entertained. But actually, I feel like that's such an indictment on the rest of us to say that we couldn't be bothered to do the work, because it's harder to be friends with, you know, the elderly, or it takes more effort to build a relationship with someone who is neurodiverse. We're going to kind of pack them off with a robot or a computer program. I feel like that would be such a failure of empathy and creativity and imagination for the wider culture to say, it's just too hard for us. So we'll let them kind of stew in this kind of quasi narcissistic relationship with a computer program that kind of parrots back what they want to hear, but it's not actually as enriching and as fulfilling as genuine human to human interaction would be.
It's a very interesting topic. I would want to draw a distinction between using these systems in a therapeutic role and using these systems as a replacement for a healthy, normal relationship. So there's growing evidence that artificial intelligence systems and robots can be used in a therapeutic role. There's a robot called Casper, spelled with a K, who has been used with children with autism as a way of teaching them, that because Casper is a very simplified representation of a face and a response, and it's a way of teaching autistic children how to read people's faces. And there is some evidence that by using this kind of system as a therapeutic role, it's actually helpful. And I could imagine for people with autism, as a way of practicing at relationships, as a way of trying out ways of interacting with people, an AI system might be quite a safe place to practice relating, but particularly for children. But obviously there's a difference from that, using something as a replacement. I can't do human beings, they're too complicated, so I'm just going to do it with my machine. What do you think about that, Aaron?
No, I think I agree with you. I think there's great potential to use it therapeutically. And I think having an AI system to practice socializing before you go out into the big bad world, I think could be very helpful. Just as you say, it's making sure it's a means to an end and not an end in itself.
Do you find the internet in general, let's say existing technology, social media, Facebook, whatever else, are those spaces that people with ASD really thrive and flourish in because it's maybe more straightforward? It lacks some of the, you know, non-verbal nuances that might be difficult if it's all text-based. Has the internet been really good in that sense for generating community for people who are neurodiverse? I'm thinking of, like, you know, subreddit threads and kind of strange forums where people can gather, and it's not as psychologically demanding maybe as getting out there and going into a group of people.
It can be very helpful, particularly when, so if you're an autistic person not particularly influenced by peer pressure, that means your interests may not align with what is quote unquote mainstream. But of course, on the internet, you can find a subreddit for absolutely anything, which does make it less isolating and gives you a bit of social interaction. Like when I was at school, Tumblr was the big thing. I don't know if it's still a thing, but certainly for teenage girls in the early 2000s, it was Tumblr. And that did give me a sense of social interaction, even if it was just online. And I think that was mostly a good thing. There was certainly a bit of avoiding the real world using the internet, which isn't great. But like everything, there's positives and negatives. I think one of the main negatives is because we are so black and white, as you know, social media is so polarizing, whether it's theology or politics or anything else. And even certain autism spaces online can actually be quite polarized because there's quite a few significant debates within the autistic community. And yeah, sometimes it's not all that pleasant. So there's positives and negatives to social media.
What are some of the, if you don't mind me asking, what are some of the kind of particularly divisive topics between that people with autism maybe disagree with each other about?
So there are some debates around the language we use. So some people prefer what's called person-first language. So that is person with autism. The idea being that it emphasises that autism is a part of you, but not all of you, whereas others, in fact, I think the majority prefer what's called identity first language, which is autistic person. And the reasoning behind that is, you know, autism isn't a disease in the same way we say a person with diabetes. It's simply an inherent part of our identity that should be celebrated. My personal opinion on the language debate is just do whatever you want, whatever works for you. But unfortunately, because it's the internet, it can be so polarized between the two quote-unquote sides.
Just again, this is a fascinating conversation. It has so many different, you know, it goes off in so many different directions. Just going, looping back to the theologies, one of the things I've noticed is that it feels that in the church as a whole, the evangelical church, sometimes it feels like there's a rise of a kind of black and white theology, a kind of non-nuanced, this is the truth, this is wrong, take it or leave it. And it seems that this is the more nuanced kind of theology, which I was certainly raised in and which I've always found attractive. It seems to be on the decline in terms of, I know it's academically, it's very much there within the academy, but in terms of local churches, it often seems that people are drawn to a kind of simplistic black and white thinking. Is that relevant in some way? I mean, is this increasing recognition of autism in some way associated with this?
I've certainly noticed, because I've lived all over the UK in the past few years, a definite trend in that the churches that are growing and are getting more young people are the black and white theology churches. And the ones that are more, I suppose you'd say, liberal are actually declining and have aging congregations, which is very surprising because from the outside, you would think that younger people would be drawn to a more progressive faith. But actually, statistics constantly show it's the opposite. I hadn't actually thought of it from a neurodiverse lens that that could actually be part of the reason. If more and more people are neurodiverse, then yes, the black and white theology would certainly appeal. It gives you a sense of community, belonging, and certainty. Because something I found when studying theology is that you have to get comfortable with uncertainty, which is really difficult when you're neurodiverse. So I can see why having a certain faith, a bit like when I went to the fundamentalist church as a teenager, is very, very appealing.
Yeah, I would want to draw a distinction between liberal churches, which I agree with you. I think liberal church, because basically it denies the spiritual power, the supernatural power of Christianity. It's I don't find it surprising that liberal churches are declining. What I would want to argue for is that what I regard as a kind of historic orthodoxy, you know, which goes all the way back to the church fathers, the orthodox biblical Christian faith, is a nuanced faith. I mean, all these fundamental doctrines about Christology, about the nature of the Trinity, about these fundamental doctrines are nuanced. They're not simplistic black and white doctrines, and therefore the challenge is how do we maintain that nuanced and yet powerful orthodoxy against a rather simplistic black and white theology which seems more attractive.
Yeah, and it was particularly interesting, sorry this might be a bit of a tangent, but particularly interesting that you mentioned the supernatural appeal of Christianity. Because something that multiple studies have demonstrated is that autistic people are far more likely to be atheist or agnostic compared to the general population. And this is because we think in a way that's quite logical and empirical. So it is very hard for us to have faith in something supernatural.
Karen, sorry, finish, yeah.
I was going to say, certainly in my case, I was drawn to such black and white theology because in some ways it almost compensated for what I lacked. And in that case, what I lacked was the quote-unquote personal relationship with Jesus.
And do you find it, do you think it is more challenging for you to kind of lean into that personal faith with Jesus because of your autism than it might be for the average other Christian side by side to you in the pew? Or do you think once you kind of unlocked that part of your faith journey, actually it's not been a kind of, I don't know what the language would be, a struggle to kind of push ahead with that?
The struggle came when I felt like I had to relate to Jesus in the same way that other people did. And if I didn't do it the same way, it was somehow invalid. So Preston Sprinkle brilliantly calls it Jesus is my boyfriend theology. It's one of my favorite phrases, because honestly, that's what it can be like sometimes. And I could just never, it never resonated with me. And I felt like a second class Christian because of it. But I think just as the years have gone on, having more understanding of myself and of theology in general, I just think it's so important to learn what works for you when it comes to connecting with God. What works for you might not work for someone else. It's often a case of trial and error. But there's no point in conforming yourself to what everyone else seems to be doing if that just isn't working for you.
And one of the wonderful things about God and about Jesus is that he is not bound up within our own social kind of man-made relational conventions, you know, in that he is both. Yes, there was this kind of man, a Jewish man in first century Palestine who lives in a particular time place, but he's also the creator of the world outside of time. And so we don't, unlike anyone else that you're meeting, you know, we don't have to engage with Jesus in the same way that we engage with those we see in the street who are specific. You know, you have to use, you know, British cultural social norms of the 2020s, you know, actually we are free because Jesus understands us in our kind of truest, deepest sense. And I think that is liberating for everyone, but maybe correct, particularly so for people who are neurodiverse.
Yeah, I read a study quite recently and it was looking at prayer specifically for people who are either nonverbal or have limited verbal speech. And generally they found that these people appreciated prayer a lot because it is a way to internally communicate with God, like you say, without any social norms, without any rules of conversation. You are just free to communicate with God in whatever form that may take.
And this comes back, I think, to this wonderful idea of uniqueness, doesn't it? That every human relationship is unique. And therefore, because each one of us is a unique person, of course, our relationship with God himself is going to be unique. And rather than sort of ape someone else's, try to copy their way, it's growing into my own uniqueness, growing into the friend who sticks closer than a brother. Mm. We need to come to the end soon, but I'm just go back to this question about genetics of autism and whether or not that's a threat coming down the line, whether prenatal diagnosis might become possible. From a technical point of view, although there's very strong research evidence of a genetic component to autism, it's different from something like Down syndrome, which is a single gene, or in Down's case, a single chromosome disorder. This is a what's called a polygenic phenomenon, which involves many genes across. So I think from a technical point of view, it's unlikely that there would be a very clear prenatal diagnosis test. It would require a very detailed analysis of the whole genome and then using artificial intelligence, in fact, to try to work out what were the risks of a particular genotype expressing itself in a particular way. But it's certainly a possibility looking down into the future. And it is a quite horrific idea, isn't it? That parents could then, this is the designer baby. I can, you know, create 100 embryos and then look at those 100 embryos and decide, I don't fancy that combination. Oh, that looks quite good. I'll go for that one.
Yeah. And this debate is incredibly relevant at the minute because there's been a lot of publicity recently about a study called Spectrum 10K at the University of Cambridge, which, as the name suggests, is taking DNA from 10,000 autistic volunteers in the hopes of trying to find out more about autism and about its genetic or environmental factors. But this study has been mired in controversy from the very beginning, because people do have fears, like you said, of essentially eugenics, the idea that if we work out precisely what causes autism, it can then be eradicated. Whereas on the other side, people defending the study would say, you know, that's not our intentions. We just need to understand more about autism because it affects so many people and we understand so little about it. And if we had more understanding, then maybe we could provide better, more tailored support. So I honestly see both sides and I don't have a very strong opinion on it, but it's a really fascinating debate. And actually the study, it was paused for a few years, but recently it has been granted ethical approval. So as far as I'm aware, it is going to happen. So that will be an interesting one to keep an eye on.
I think it's probably important to see this in the context of what's happening with genomics generally, because obviously there are very special features about autism, but it would be true to say that this is being done, the same kind of approach is being used in the complete range of human variation. So, you know, I think my instinct is to say that scientific discovery in itself is always valuable, but the more the potential for abuse, the more stricter the guidelines have to be. The problem in prenatal diagnosis is this kind of consumerism, which is particularly in the States, where it's a kind of free market economy. If I want to spend $100,000 finding the ideal child, you have no right to stop me. You know, here in the NHS, we can be much more prescriptive in terms of what we would make available, what would not be made available, and so on. But you can see the threat of the free market economy that basically says, if I'm spending hundreds of thousands of pounds on buying private education for my child, and I'm allowed to do that, why am I not allowed to spend hundreds of thousands of pounds on selecting the best child in the first place?
Yeah, it is such a fascinating debate. But when we think about what we would miss out on if we didn't have autism, you know, we mentioned earlier in the conversation about all the scientists and authors down the years that have had either confirmed or suspected autism. If everyone was quote unquote genetically perfect, we would miss out on just the beautiful variety of humanity. But I also realize that it's not quite that simple, and I've never been a parent, so I also can't particularly comment on matters of parenting, but it is a fascinating debate.
I have to say, I really sympathize with those who worry about these studies or worry about the potential of finding quote unquote the autistic gene, even though I understand it's not that simple. But because I think while you're right, Dad, that kind of knowledge is in itself a good thing and we should try and understand more about the world and ourselves, the question is, can you trust our current society to use that knowledge ethically and appropriately? And I think I go back to that question that we started the episode with from Christian listener saying, you know, you look at what's happened with things like Down syndrome, which again is very different. It's an easier thing to diagnose, but when we did gain the knowledge of being able to find out if a child has Down syndrome in utero before they're born, sadly, when the new non-invasive, much kind of higher accuracy test was rolled out, abortion rates for Down syndrome have approached 99%. And society might say, oh no, Down syndrome people are wonderful, they're a blessing to us, we want to include them. But when the rubber hit the road and we gave people the knowledge and the power, unfortunately, from my perspective, the vast majority of people choose not to have children with Down syndrome. And I can really sympathize with those in the autistic community who worry about a similar scenario unfolding for them.
Yeah, I agree. And this consumerist approach to having a child is something I feel very strongly against. And you know, I think it's not a coincidence in the creation, in the way that God has made the creation, is that you don't learn about your child until they're born. You know, the baby is this kind of mysterious other. And then this wonderful little bundle comes out and you fall in love with them because they're just so wonderful. And then as a parent, over the next 18 years, you discover all the unpleasant and revolting genetic characteristics that they've got. But by then it's too late because you've fallen in love with them. Whereas once you turn it around the other way, I discover all this truth about my unborn baby. I discover all these facts about their genome before I've met them. And actually, I think that in some ways that distorts the way it was meant to be, the creation order, that we meet our children first and then we learn about them.
I guess the other angle, you mentioned, Aaron, that the people running the study say that they want to try and understand more about autism, potentially to develop treatments for it. I imagine that in itself is probably also quite controversial within the ASD community, whether autism, you know, could in the future be treated. Should you want to take that treatment to become neurotypical, if that was an option, or actually is being neurodiverse not something to be kind of treated away? I wonder, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think from my view, it's not so much the magic pill that will cure autism and make you neurotypical, but more so, can we treat specific aspects of it that make life more difficult? So I suppose I'm more looking at treating certain symptoms rather than autism as a whole. So, for example, in my case, and in the case of many of my friends who have been diagnosed with autism, all the NHS can really offer us is sertraline. I mean, that does help with some of the depression, anxiety aspects of living in a society that's not quite adapted for you. But in an ideal world, I wish there was more on offer than just here's some sertraline.
Yeah.
It's particularly true about the people who are really struggling, you know, with very severe symptoms. I think as a paediatrician, you know, if we had some kind of intervention which would really improve children in the very severe category, those who have no language, just in terms of improving their ability to communicate, you know, that would be a very powerful and valuable resource. And this, again, it just reflects the spectrum, doesn't it? That's almost applying the same label to someone like you, Aaron, and someone in the most profoundly affected sense. It doesn't make a lot of sense to apply the same label because the situations are so different.
Yeah, which then makes me think, should we be doing the level 1, 2, 3 diagnosis that they do in the States? But then some of the criticism of that is that even that's too black and white. You know, some people can be born a certain level and then develop into another one as they get older. So there's no perfect categories. But I do agree that the autism spectrum has almost become too broad, so broad that we can't properly talk about it.
Mm-hmm. And I guess this almost comes back to, on the question of treatment, back to your mention earlier about whether you use kind of person forward language or identity forward language. Because this debate reminds me, you know, there's a kind of very active debate within Christian disability communities, you know, about, you know, some people there very strongly feel like, I don't want to be cured of my disability. I want society to be adapted so that my disability is no longer a hindrance or a barrier. And in the new creation, I'm not going to suddenly lose my disability. It's just I'm going to live in a society in which it is no longer kind of a hindrance. And people might see their disability as a central part of how God made them, about their identity, and not something to be kind of cured away. And I suspect, tell me if I'm wrong, there's a probably similar diversity of approach within the autism community, where some people say, I don't want to, if this is part of my identity, I don't want it to be cured in the future or even in the new creation.
Yeah, and this is sort of getting a bit into disability theory, but there's what's called the social model of disability, which is that the difficulties that come with disability on the whole are actually caused by society's reaction to it rather than the disability in and of itself. And certainly with autism, a lot of the suffering could be prevented by a society that's more welcoming and inclusive. But on the other hand, some of the suffering is simply inherent, and no amount of societal support will stop that. So it's interesting. Hmm.
Well, we have been going for over an hour. I think we should probably draw it to a close there. As you can tell, it's a really fascinating topic. And so we've really enjoyed learning and listening to you, Erin, and I hope the listeners have as well. Thank you so much for coming on the show and telling us your story and sharing some of your thoughts and expertise. I found it really enjoyable. And thank you, everyone else, for listening as well. As we mentioned, this whole episode was inspired by a question from a listener. So please do carry on sending in your questions, your thoughts, your disagreements, your comments. You can reach us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. And as always, there's lots of other interesting things you could read or listen to or watch on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. Erin, do you have a website? You wrote a book recently, didn't you? Do you want to explain how people can get hold of your book if they want to find out a bit more?
Yes, my book is called With All Your Mind, Autism and the Church. And it's a popular version of the dissertation I wrote at uni, which was about autistic adults and the church. So it is quite short, but it's intended to be a short introduction. My website is erinburnettauthor.co.uk.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Erin. It was lovely to have you on the show. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.